everyone. Picture an old man. Seems normal, right? Now picture the sea. Today's book is The Old Man and the Sea by John Grisham.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and the first time I read The Old Man and the Sea, I was a teenager, and it was almost as boring as actual fishing. But I read it later, and now it's one of my top two favorite novels.
And I'm David Vance. As a kid, I was horrified to learn about catch and release fishing, where you catch a fish just to hurt it. The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway is a modern classic about perseverance, mastery, and failure. It was also Saddam Hussein's favorite book.
And this is The Book Pile. All right, we are so excited to have Chad Daniels with us today. I first heard Chad on Pandora. That's how I discovered him. I also discovered later that he has almost 1 billion tracks listened to.
Wow.
On Pandora. He's got 5 albums in there. They are great. He also has a special, Comedy Central special, a special on Amazon Prime that you can check out called Dad Chaniels. And of course, my favorite podcast, Middle of Somewhere. Please welcome Chad Daniels.
Hello. Hi.
Hey there.
How's it going?
Great. I had just asked Chad before if there are any credits that he wanted mentioned, and he said basically no thanks, which is so refreshing because I once worked with Chris Kattan, and he gave me 10 things.
Yeah.
I have them somewhere in my phone, but he had me mention the years he was on SNL, every movie he's been in,
sure.
That there's a third season of Bunnyicula, some cartoon that he's on.
That is somebody hanging on with such a tight grip that they need every, it is like the 4-year-old son or daughter saying, look at me, look at me, look at me, dad, look at me, look at me. That's what that is the equivalent to me anyways. Because you can give them as many credits as you want when you're going on stage. But the issue is you get a 5-minute grace period. And if you're not funny, those credits don't mean anything.
100%. Yeah, I've brought up that example to people that if like Brad Pitt did stand up, he could sell out a stadium, but like a minute in, everyone would be like, are there refunds?
Well, I don't know if that's Jeremy Piven. Oh, I'm sorry. That was a Freudian slip. I don't know if that's true. That's not true. I don't really know a lot about his stand up.
As far as getting laughs.
Right. No. I just know that, you know, Piven is famous for movies. PCU, I watched probably 100 times when I was in college. And then, you know, I got to work with him at Moon Tower in Austin, Texas. It was nuts. But I was going to tell you about this guy that I introduced once. He wanted me to say, tell him I was in Saving Private Ryan. Okay. And so I was like, okay. So I went on stage and I said, hey, this guy was in Saving Private Ryan. And then he went on stage and he would say, well, idiot over there can't get an intro, right? I was in Shaving Ryan's Privates, the porn, you know. And so,
whoa.
So then I go on stage, the late show, and I go, hey, you guys, this guy was in Shaving Ryan's Privates. And he comes on stage. He's like, you ruined my joke. And I go, I'm a grown man. I'm not going to get yelled at for making a mistake I didn't make. You can't make me make the mistake and then also yell at me.
I love the idea of the pretty assistant undermining every magic trick.
Yeah.
pointing to the trick doors.
Just like really trying to not let the magician see, though. She's just got one finger off of her right thigh. Like, look at that. Look at over there.
I'm so glad that people weren't recording things secretly on cell phones when I started comedy, because I remember hosting a show where it was a short black man, and he wanted me to introduce him as this next guy auditioned for Different Strokes but lost the role to Gary Coleman. So I get up there, I say that, and I walk off the stage, and he just looks at me really coldly, and he goes, well, that guy's racist. So it wasn't even like a joke. He made it seem like I came up with it.
Oh, that's so fantastic. That is so fantastic that he led you into just...
He catfished you into racism.
Unbelievable. I actually admire that quite a bit by that guy.
Chad and I met in Omaha a year and a half ago. It's a really fun story full of compliments about me that you can check out on...
Kellen's favorite kind of story.
Chad's podcast, Middle of Somewhere. I had the honor of being a guest on his podcast earlier this week. So please check that out. All right. So I want to get each of our stories of how The Old Man and the Sea has affected us. But of course, I want to start with you. It's one of my two favorite novels. And I found out through another comedy club manager that The Old Man and the Sea was absolutely your favorite novel. I would love to hear the story behind that, how you were introduced to it and how you've experienced it since then.
Well, I was interested. First of all, I corrected you on my podcast when you called it a novel because it's a novella. just 88 pages without pictures, unless you get one of the picture books. Then it's 93.
You know how many.
But, so what I started doing a while ago is in high school, I didn't necessarily try. I mean, you know, you always hear about the parents going to PTA meetings and the teacher saying, well, if he would just put forth some effort. That was every single time my mom went. And she just stopped going because she was like, let me guess, you have to put forth effort? And so I didn't read it in high school, even though it was on, you know, it's on a lot of the high school reading lists, the curriculum. So I went back and I started reading all the books that were on the high school curriculum list because I thought, well, obviously somebody thinks these are good. And then I came upon this one and it was at a time, I mean, every time I read it, it's at a time in my life where it makes complete sense and I can draw different things from it. But at that time, I just really fell in love with the idea that this guy was not going to stop. He is a fisherman, and he will fish. And that is it, you know? I mean, not to get too, you know, cheesy or whatever, but, you know, there's a time I had a family. I still have a family, but when I was reading it, I had young children and I was out on the road and I got a lot of questions about that. Like, oh, you know, you're away from your kids and you're doing this. And I put so much effort into getting back to my children. I never missed anything that was important other than sometimes I wasn't there for like homework in the evening. Right. But they could always call me. And that's what it felt like with him. You know, sometimes it's like, oh, I've gone too far out. I have gone too far out. And, you know, the lights of Havana, that glow that he was always looking for, kind of always felt like home a little bit. So it really just hit me as, holy crap, this is incredible. And some of the lines in there, you know, of course, I was always looking for justification for leaving and stuff like that. So it made me feel better, but kind of opened my eyes too about, you know, people are who they are. I have long admired these guys that can grill with their shirts off and absolutely should not. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I appreciate you can grill with your shirt off, but you're grilling food for nothing because no one's hungry anymore. Because you have your shirt off. Everyone has lost their appetite. But I admire that about them because it's just who they are, you know? And there's a line, of course. You can't admire people, you know, just like, well, that's what he does. He storms the Capitol. I mean, there has to be a line in the sand about that, of course. But when you're speaking generally, it's like people are happy with who they are. And that's not everybody finds that. And so I just fell in love with Santiago and really the whole book.
Well, that's what I thought was incredible too about it. You end up rooting for him in a way that, like, when you're watching a horror movie, you're always like, ugh, just don't go in the house.
Right.
But when you're with Santiago and he's got this fish and he's just headed out into the open sea for days, it's always in the back of your mind like, yeah, he should go back, but he should also keep going.
Right.
Like he needs to catch this.
Yeah. He's on day 84.
And I need to see him.
Yeah, he's on day 84 of not catching a fish, and 87 is the longest he's ever gone. And so it's like, it's just mind blowing to think that everyone at the village is kind of like, oh, the old guy's going back out, but he's not the old guy. He's this beaten up body with more knowledge than five of the fishermen in the village put together. And so you do cheer for him, and you're like, if you have to go all the way to more land, if you have to go all the way to Florida, go catch a fish.
I do love that idea of him having that more knowledge than everybody else. I remember reading an interview from the head of content at FX, and he talked about how FX loves doing superhero stories in the broadest sense, where a superhero is someone who has powers that you, the reader or viewer, don't have. So from that perspective, like Dexter is a superhero, the Americans are superheroes.
Sure.
And I had a sense of that in this book where, you know, you see the depth of his fishing knowledge and his knowledge of the sea and his attention to craft, and you get this sense of just a vast well of knowledge and experience that isn't accessible to you, but that's very interesting to kind of peer in on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this guy, he has a fishing line between his forefinger and his thumb that is 100 fathoms, which I didn't know what that was, but it's 600 feet. It's 1 fathom is 6 feet.
Cool.
It's 600 wow. feet down, and he is describing in detail what is happening when the marlin is trying to get one of the little bait fish off of the tip of the hook. I mean, it's just mind-blowing that he can hold on to a line and feel that. You could spell a word in my hand, Helen Keller style, while I was watching you with a flashlight on my hand, and I'd be like, I don't know, is it hippopotamus? I mean, I'd have no idea. And this guy's holding a line describing what's going on under 600 feet underwater. It's just, it's crazy.
I would love to know like how much research Hemingway put into it, because it just seems like, it seems like he's lived an entire lifetime of doing this.
I read that Hemingway had written this story, this short story before for a magazine. And then he was going to write a bunch of short stories, but he ended up having to ditch that project because For Whom the Bell Tolls took off into 1,500 pages or whatever it was. It wasn't until 15 years later that he came back to this idea. And he actually went out in a boat in Cuba with this guy named Carlos. And I'm sure it was just feverishly taking notes about the experience, because listeners will have to look it up. But I can't remember if Carlos was the guy this is based on, about catching a gigantic fish and sharks just destroy it before he gets back. But he went out on a boat, yeah, with this guy named Carlos, with his buddy. I think it's Carlos. I don't know.
Chad, we just make assertions and just count on nobody fact-checking
us.
Oh,
no, it's definitely Carlos. It's definitely Carlos.
I love the idea, too, that Hemingway was like, man, I'm going to revisit this short story and make it barely longer.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
On that subject of Hemingway clearly just knowing a lot about fishing, that seems like a good place to bring up our lesson one for today, which is create with deep knowledge. So Hemingway is famous for what he called iceberg theory, which we talked about in our On Writing episode, where, you know, the basic idea is if you know your subject really well, you can leave things out and the reader will still feel them. So he says the dignity of the movement of an iceberg is due to only 1/8 of it being above water. So I love that you can just feel throughout this whole book how much he knows about fishing and being on the sea.
I thought his iceberg theory was that when you're fishing, watch out for icebergs. I first read it because it was required reading in high school. I was very bored with it.
Rule follower, I wish I had a cool story at nerd.
That it was just... At the time, I was really into like Ray Bradbury, who has a real flowery way of speaking, and this sort of fantastical sci-fi tales of
right.
being on Mars and Venus and in the future. And then this story, if you're going to pitch it, which has been made into 3 movies, I'm not sure how, if you're going to pitch it, it'd be like, so there's a guy on a boat. What do you think?
There used to be 2 guys in a boat. One of them's no longer allowed to go. Does that spice it up? Does that get it? It's funny you bring up Ray Bradbury as we're looking at 3 screens in a Zoom room looking at each other. It's just like, has anyone ever been more right It's just insane. It's insane.
And I just burned all my books and paintings this morning.
That sounds about right. That sounds.
I've always wanted to burn a copy of Fahrenheit 451.
So that was my experience as a teenager. Then I came back to it when I was in my 20s because I was embarrassing to admit. I had always loved reading, but I had never read stuff that I thought was quote unquote important. And The Old Man and the Sea is, as you pointed out, a very short novel. Novella still sounds like I'm cheating when I read it. Like I didn't read a whole book. But it was one of them. And that was the first time that it really came out to me, that themes of it really – it's sort of a living book in that sense, that like you were saying, wherever you are in life, the certain things will sort of protrude from it. And at the time, I was trying to figure out my relationship with my brothers, which I had sort of grown farther from one and closer to the other. And I wanted to be more connected. And there are all these themes in the book about that he brings up about relationships, but specifically brotherhood, the connection with me, you know, me and the ship are brothers. At one point, like the stars, I'm brothers with the stars. Also like his hands
and the
are
fish,
his brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, his hands and the fish. And so that those sort of themes came out to me. And then I read it again in my early 30s. And that's, yeah, when more of like the parental side came forth. And he keeps saying stuff like, if only the boy were here. And then recently I listened to it. And you can find it on Audible if Donald Sutherland reading it.
Ooh, interesting.
And Chad, yeah, a couple of weeks ago you mentioned that you fell asleep listening to Matthew McConaughey reading a story on YouTube.
Yep.
Well, if you think that puts you to sleep, just imagine the dad from Pride and Prejudice reading a story about a fisherman.
He's like, Victorian England's gotten a little too raucous for me. What's something calmer?
It's really good though, because like most books that I listen to, especially nonfiction, I'll try and like double the speed as much as I can to just get that information in. But I had to keep it.
Hey, where,
the crazy
hey,
thing
Kellen,
about
where do you get your information? Mostly the chipmunks, Alvin, Simon, and Theodore. It starts out as a normal person, but it's going so fast that I can't tell it's not them.
Well, it's funny because with most books, if you listen to it at double speed and then take it back to regular speed, it sounds like you've put them in slow motion. But Donald Sutherland already talks naturally at about half speed. But
so
it's so soothing. But you should try it, Dad. It's like, Dad. Oh,
wow.
Boy. Oh,
well.
Speaking of Freudian.
Well.
I think the podcast is about something else now.
Chad, I can't imagine, Chad, this is the first time that's happened. You said that in general, you are like, you impose like father figure onto strangers in public.
Yeah, so this
can't be the first time someone has called you dad.
Yeah, just because my name, you can flip it. That's where I got the name for the special Dad Chaniels, is I would have.
That's great.
I would have 18-year-old kids at shows coming up to me and, you know, taking pictures before pandemic. And they'd be like, hey, Dad Chaniels, will you be my dad? Like, just stupid stuff like that. So, because I'm talking about a child their age, and, you know, sure, they're just like, will you yell at me like that? I don't understand the fascination why anyone would want me to be their father after they hear those stories, but I just want to go, I don't know what's going on at your house, but holy crap, that must be ridiculous.
I love that I get, hey, tell me a joke, and you get, hey, father me. Father me loudly.
That sounds like someone trying to be sexy and just failing.
Yeah, it really does. That sounds like it always ends with no thank you.
So, Dave, what's your story with Old Man and the Sea?
My story with it
interesting.
Is kind of...
So, Chad, I wanted to know...
That actually startled me because I was really getting ready to listen. I was taking hold. I was zoning in. And then, oh, man.
No, mine's quick. I read it in high school, and because everyone else didn't like it, I like performatively pretended to not like it too. Like, oh, homework, right, guys? But I really did enjoy it. And then I just reread it last year. And the thing that stuck out the most to me about it was it's just full of all these just little gems of quotes. There's one that I now, it's like now the opening quote in my journal because it stuck with me so profoundly. It's where he says, "It is better to be lucky, but I would rather be exact than when luck comes, you are ready." There are all these little things that honestly feel so sparse and biblical that it's like a little book of aphorisms. So yeah, I really enjoyed it both times.
I didn't understand a lot of the words you just said, but it sounded it sounded like you enjoyed the book. No, I completely agree. There's so many interesting things in here. On the first page, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something like everything about him is old except his eyes. They are the color of the sea, and they are championing and undefeated, something like that. And it's just interesting because, you know, you can wear down the body, but you still have that. I think there's so much talk about youth and getting old in this book. Like when he talks about the young lions on the African coast, and he talks about the boy. A lot of times when he's in the boat and he says, "I wish the boy were here," I wonder if he's talking about, I don't know how to say it because I've only read it. It's like when I used to pronounce Hermione Hermoine when I was reading the book because I had no idea. I had no reference to go on. So Manolin, whatever the kid's name is. But I wonder when Santiago's in the boat and he says, "I wish the boy were here," I wonder if he's calling for his youth, his strength, because he knows his body is just getting beaten down by this thing and he wishes he was stronger. I mean, I think there's a lot of that throughout the book.
I love that takeaway. I hadn't considered that. It struck me at the very end. It ends with him dreaming of the lions in Africa, but it's not about Africa. It's about how old he was when he would sail by the coast of Africa.
Sure. Yeah, I think he is, you know, I mean, listen, I'm 45 and I can't stand it already. So I get it. You know, and even last night I said something and my daughter is kind of the voice of reason around here. And she goes, "Everyone gets old." And it's like, I know that, but it doesn't mean I have to like it. I don't want to get old, you know, and I'm not doing anything to change it. I eat like an absolute idiot.
The Old Man of the Sea would be a very different book if he's just like slamming Krispy Kremes the entire time.
Yeah, he's talking about, oh, I sure wish I had a lime or some salt. And I'm just like, where is little Debbie? Why isn't she on this boat with me?
That's I can't stand when people, like, I've been losing my hair since I was 22. It's very hard for me. And people with full heads of hair, of course, are the only ones that have the advice. They're like, "You just need to accept it, man." And I'm like, you can't just say something and make it happen. Like, it's accepted me, but I.
Now, let me ask you something, and you can't pick both here. Would you rather be losing your hair since 21 and be thin and handsome, or would you rather have a full head of hair and have to grow a beard to cover a double chin and be chubby and be racing towards 50? Answer me. I'm just kidding. You wanted a dad? Here he comes. Answer me.
Oh my God. So that was the other thing that stuck out to me this last time that I listened to the book, the last time that my other father figure read it to me.
Kiefer's so mad at you right now.
But the themes of mortality in it, I love one of the lines in it. He asks this sort of hypothetical question, but then he answers it in a really like smart philosophical way. He says, "Why do old men wake so early? Is it to have one more longer day?"
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, man, I need to start getting up earlier.
Oh, that's, what if this book ruined your relationship with your children because all you did is yell at them after 6 p.m. because you were so tired?
But then you inexplicably want to bring them out deep sea fishing.
Another couple of quotes that I love. I love, he says, "Anyone can be a fisherman in May." It's like a real condescending.
Oh, I've said that to people before. I love that quote so much because it's absolutely true. You know, it's like when you were a lot of times when I see somebody that, you know, has some cash and then I say, oh, what do you do? And they go, oh, well, my parents started this company and I run it. And it's like, well, anybody can be a fisherman in May. I'll always just throw that in there. And they don't know what that is. I mean, there's, you know. So
yeah. How many times did you say that in Aspen?
Probably a lot. Probably daily, I would think. I love the quote. And again, I should have written these down and my apologies. So I'm always paraphrasing. But he's talking about sin and is it a sin to kill the fish? He's getting mad at himself for getting lost in thought and having these discussions. He goes, people get paid to have these discussions. I should leave it to them. And then he says, but the truth is, I don't think it's a sin because I was born a fisherman and the fish was born a fish. So I just think that mm-hmm. goes back to being who you are. It's kind of a reminder of, well, this is how it goes, right? And again, I just to repeat, no one was born to storm the Capitol. That's not part of it.
So much of the story, and this is how I don't understand how you could even make a movie. I haven't bothered trying to watch any of the movies because the book isn't so much a story of a guy fishing. It's a story of a man's thought process while he is fishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're taking a ride in his head. And that's where these wonderful things, quotes and thoughts and sort of philosophies come out. But there's one that stuck out to me. It's the line where he says something about there's pain in a moment.
The line is, so it's the first time he sees the sharks coming when he knows that like doom is closing in. I, he said aloud, there is no translation for this word, and perhaps it is just a noise such as a man might make involuntarily, feeling the nail go through his hands and into the wood.
Yeah, and so this is the only like really direct sort of parallel with Jesus, but he sort of throws that in there so that maybe you can think of it more during the story. I like to think that once Hemingway wrote that down, he was like, well, that'll make people talk about this enough to get me the Pulitzer. Because it's just sort of this little teaser just to sort of make you think, but it digs the whole story down like another layer.
Absolutely. And he was probably like, oh, and I'm glad I picked the name Santiago because backwards it spells Jesus. You know what? I'm drunk again. Where's my gun?
On the gun topic, in a less dark way than the normal Hemingway gun topic, apparently when he went deep sea fishing, he hated it so much when sharks would eat the fish that he would bring a Tommy gun and he would try to like gun down the sharks in the water.
That doesn't surprise me even a little.
Like a gangster from the movies?
Uh-huh.
Like a Tommy. So I love that there will be those moments of that eye and then this really sort of deep... what does this mean moment? And then at another point, he just calls a jellyfish a whore. And I have no idea what that is supposed to mean.
Isn't he? He's just so mad at these jellyfish because in his head, he can't figure out what they're for. It's like you see these beautiful translucent, maybe is the word he uses, something in the water. And all they do is sting you and leave you with like a poison ivy or a poison oak finish to your skin. And that's why he loves turtles, because they just go around and eat them so quickly.
Oh, so he's just insulting it. So are you telling me that there are fishermen out there who are sexist?
No, I don't think so. What I'm saying is, I don't know if you've seen the movie The Perfect Storm, but when John C. Reilly is going down in the boat, he looks at his bunkmate and he says, this is going to be hard on my kids, which is a... stealing I Wish the Boy Were Here from Ernest Hemingway. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows.
Oh, wow.
not even close to real, but man, it felt smart for just a little bit. And then I saw your guys' eyes shift and I knew you were no longer believing me.
I do. But that's how well this book is written, is that like you can speculate with things on that, and like bringing up John C. Reilly almost makes sense in a conversation where we're also talking about another JC. All right, we just have like maybe 5 minutes. Was there anything else? This has been so fun, by the way, Chad. Yeah.
I've had a blast talking about this. Normally people don't talk to me about this book. I'll talk about one more if I could.
Absolutely.
So I know like a long time ago, we were right at the beginning of this, we were talking about how when we all read the book and what we took from it and all that stuff. And I was talking about my kids and everything. But there have been times where I've read this. It's kind of like you're on the road and you're working and you're writing and you're doing everything you can and you keep going further and you keep going further. And you have these projects that you're working on. You're making all these calls. And then you finally, boom, hit a marlin. You have to hold on for dear life. And as soon as you do, we didn't hear about a shark in this book until the marlin was strapped to the boat.
Yeah.
And now you have, and again, I know there are a lot of good ones, but I'm saying there are a lot of people in show business that want to make money off of you finally getting successful. And I just always wanted to be like, if you want to pay me some sort of back taxes for the 15 years I was doing this all by myself, absolutely. Right. I'd be happy to give you 10% of this check. But but that's not how it works. And it was one of the times that I was reading this book is when I had done this big college tour and I had a college agent that was booking everything, but I still had to pay three different people a percentage because they were just in my life. And I just kind of was like, I don't know what to do about this. And I burned some bridges.
You're saying the sharks have a better business model.
Yes, absolutely.
I love the people who read this book and their takeaway was, oh, I'm gonna be an agent. I want to be the shark.
But I've
they played their cards right.
Sometimes you walk up to managers and agents and you try to find where their spinal cord meets their brain in case you have to tape a knife to an oar. just to get them off the marlin a little bit.
That was such a crazy thought process that I don't know if it had happened before or if Hemingway was just in a real like violent mood. And he like maybe he was out of his Tommy gun was out of ammo. But the moment when Santiago is like, I could have cut off the sword of the swordfish and tied it to an oar and we could have fought the sharks together is how he put it.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's in with this fish. He believes in his heart of hearts, this fish and him, the universe has brought them together and that's what they do. Because he even references earlier in the book when he's fighting him, he's like, maybe you'll die or maybe you'll kill me. I mean, he's willing to do that because I think he feels like a real kinship with this fish.
I love that. Yeah. That would have been great if that's what George Lucas was trying to do with Empire Strikes Back, where he's like, we'll fight the Emperor together. He cuts off Luke's hand and then just sort of uses it to slap the Emperor. He's like, we're fighting him together.
Maybe
father and son.
Maybe that's what the A-Y is in the book. Maybe it's actually and when Hemingway was hearing it in his head, it was maybe that's why there's no translation.
There's no translation.
Yeah, right.
Perhaps it is the sound a Wookiee makes when a blaster pins him to a
I would love if the Pulitzer people listened to this and they were like, yeah, I think we'll take that award back now.
He won a Nobel for it too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which anyone can. So real quick, I just want to hit on our second lesson from the book, which is respect your enemy. So I'm kind of struck throughout the whole book, just the level of respect that he has for the fish, to the point where at one point he says, fish, I love you and respect you very much, but I will kill you dead before this day ends, which I imagine is what it feels like to be a teacher. And I think historically you see these major disasters of what happens when you don't take your enemy seriously. Like the Union didn't take the Confederacy seriously. The Allies at first didn't take the threat of Germany seriously. All this to say, I think there's a lot of value in respecting your enemy, which is why I made a podcast with Kellen. All right, to recap, here are our favorite lessons from The Old Man and the Sea. 1, create with deep knowledge. 2, respect your enemy.
And 3, if you have dreams of writing a novel, I mean, you can sort of just cut those in half.
And idiots will still call it a novel.
Well, number four, I am piggybacking number two because, I think that when you think back to cultures that honor the kill before they eat it, and they really understand that balance of nature. I've always thought that was necessary, I guess. And then I really think that the respect that Santiago has for the fish, and, you know, there are times in the book where you're like, oh, Santiago has gone crazy. He doesn't remember. He doesn't have a casting net.
Yeah.
And he keeps asking himself, when did I start talking to myself? That's not a good look. But, you know, and then he thinks that the fish has respect for him too because of this long, drawn out battle that they're having. My book knowledge drops off quite a bit after this book. So if you guys ever if you guys ever want to talk about Elephant, Please Don't Sneeze, let me know. I almost have that memorized. I read that a lot when my kids were younger.
Another thing Hemingway loved shooting.
Yes, right.